Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, yes, the political climate in the United States is marked by ultra-partisanship. So it's a good time to ask, how's the Constitution holding up? A recent event brought together two gentlemen with a depth of political and jurisprudent experience to explore that question. Attorney William Ruckelshaus was the first director of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. He also served briefly as Deputy Attorney General under President Nixon. He lost that job during the infamous Saturday Night Massacre. Unwilling to obey Nixon's order to fire Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox, Ruckelshaus resigned. Bob Ferguson is Washington State's Attorney General. He came to national fame for his successful court challenge to President Trump's Muslim ban. He is also a master chess player, which factors into his approach to his job. Ruckelshaus and Ferguson participated in this event titled Constitutional Stress Test: Can the Democracy Survive the Current President? They took questions from Larry Hubble, director of Seattle University's Institute of Public Service, and multimedia journalist Joni Balter at SU's Piggott Hall on January 11th. Jenny Cecil Moore recorded the event. We're presenting our broadcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to kuow.org/speakersforum.
And off we go. So, Mr. Ruckelshaus, you're pretty well known for that moment where you refused to fire Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox. Let's relive that moment for a second here. Very briefly, why did you refuse to obey your president?
Because what he was asking me to do was not defensible. He was, in my judgment, he was fundamentally wrong in discharging Archibald Cox, who had been appointed with the president's blessing as well as the attorney general's. When I was confirmed as deputy attorney general, which was the position I held when I was fired.
How long did you hold that position?
Pardon me?
How long were you deputy?
20 minutes. Oh, no.
No, wait
a minute.
No,
I was attorney general 20 minutes. That was between the time Elliot got fired and I got fired. That's not long enough to get your picture on the wall down there. In any event, all that week had been a firestorm, much like every week since 1st of January in the current administration. Chaos reigned. There was an effort to keep the tapes that would have revealed Nixon's worst offenses from possession of the special prosecutor, from the possession of the Congress, who also was investigating it, just like this going on now. It's almost eerie how close it is. In any event, when the president first asked Elliot, who refused, and then myself, my feeling is that being in the high levels of American government is something I would recommend everybody in this room to be, have that opportunity. But you have to tell yourself when you take one of those jobs, there are lines I won't step over. I'm not sure what they are. I can't define them in advance, but you just have to say if you think that what you're being asked to do is fundamentally wrong. You simply have to say, I'm not going to do that. It's really not that hard a decision once you've said that to yourself beforehand. That's a short version of what
Thank
I
you. Mr. Attorney General, you are famous, among other things, for lawsuits. And I asked you when you came in if I missed one today, but you have sued the federal government, the Trump administration to be specific, 19 times. Is that number good? Okay. So in general, we're talking government 101. Is this an effective way to curb the power of any president?
Sure. So thanks, Joni, for having me here. Thanks to all of you for being here. It's an honor to be here, especially with Mr. Ruckelhaus. A big round of applause for him. I mean, he's really just a legendary figure. So, and he's obviously a fantastic role model for anyone who's interested in public service of any kind. So it's an honor to be here with you, Bill. Joni did ask me as we're on stage if I'd sued the administration today. I said no, but I approved another filing today. So stay tuned. stay tuned for that. I guess in terms of whether it's effective. I went to law school because I believe in the power of the law, right? A courthouse is the great leveler. It's an even playing field. It's not the loudest voice that prevails in a courthouse. It's the Constitution, and I believe that, and that's why I went to law school. And so I do think it's been effective. You mentioned 19 lawsuits. 5 of those cases have been decided. There's no more appeals. The cases are over. We're 5-0. We won all 5 of those. So. I think it is. I can't, the law can't solve all the problems. Some of those have to be worked out in the political manner through Congress with the president, right? But when the president acts in unconstitutional fashion, we all have a role to play. Bill had his, and my role, I think, is pretty clear to, when appropriate, to take the administration to court.
I'd like to ask this question to both of you, and I'll start with Bob. Could you give us an assessment of where we stand as a country in terms of our democracy right now?
I was hoping Bill would go first on that one, right? I'm an optimist by nature. I'm just going to start with that. I'm an optimist by nature. So take what I say with that lens in mind. Is our democracy, and let me take another statement. Do I think this is a dark time for our country with this administration? Hell yes. Okay, I mean, it's to be clear. Now, that said, yes, is our democracy under stress from this president? I believe that. In particular with what I find of many troubling things, especially troubling is core institutions, our press, the judiciary, the attacks on those institutions. There's a corrosive effect that happens with that when the president speaks in the way that he does. It may be hard to undo those. That said, on the positive side, hey, he has been checked in the courts, right? He's losing over and over and over again in the courts. And I think the press has really demonstrated itself as well in the way it's holding the president accountable. The courts have done that as well. So in a way, it's also what's going on has demonstrated the strength of our democracy. I think our democracy ultimately is stronger than any one person, no matter how corrosive I think that person is. So I have a lot of faith in our institutions. I think those institutions are demonstrating their strength in the past year, and I think that'll continue for as long as he's president.
I think what Bob is doing is preserving the essential role of our institutions. And if in periods like this, when these institutions are under attack, particularly from an administration that's supposed to be administering all of them, it's very necessary for them to have supporters in other branches of government. And the judiciary is today the one branch that is holding on to some of the essential pieces of our institutions. If you take Environmental Protection Agency as an example, it's under assault from within to try to change a lot of the progress that we've made over the last 45 years. And the courts are the last resort, really, where many of the assignments that EPA has are being undercut by the individual running it. And because Attorneys General like Bob and others around the country are willing to step up and fight those changes, those fundamental changes in the courts, it not only slows it down, but in some cases stops. I think in spite of the fact that we are in a very chaotic period now, our institutions are holding. It's necessary for us all to keep our eyes on them because their support is from us is going to be absolutely necessary for them to survive. But I would agree with Bob, the essential nature of our democracy today is in the strength of our institutions and our values like equality and freedom that are being preserved by these same institutions.
Mr. Attorney General, I've had to check my phone throughout the day to make sure I didn't miss anything on DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. At one point this week, President Trump was preparing to use DACA in negotiations for other immigration reforms. Clearly, it was about the wall. That seemed clear. But a federal judge this week in California announced that DACA will temporarily remain the law of the land. So since you've been involved in lawsuits like that, what do you think is the impact, both on President and the Congress, of the lawsuit on DACA, yours and you referred when we were talking here, to another one? So there's a couple of them going, many of them going.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I'll try and keep it short and feel free to follow up. So there are two main lawsuits challenging the President's decision to end the protections for Dreamers in our country, effective in early March, I believe. Just to be clear, there's about 800,000 Dreamers in the country. There's thousands of Dreamers here in Washington State. As you know, these are individuals brought here as children through no fault of their own. They have to meet certain criteria to qualify as Dreamers and to stay in our country. Those protections end, I think, on March 5th, given the President's decision. I filed a lawsuit with a number of other states. We have a hearing on our case next week. California filed their own lawsuit. They have so many Dreamers, as you know. And it was that decision where the court said they granted the injunction for the plaintiff, saying the President cannot take that action. The implications are, I mean, part legal, part political, right? On the legal front, we'll see what the administration does. Do they appeal that right to the Ninth Circuit or not? We'll see with our hearing, which is currently scheduled for next week in New York, what happens there. Does that judge agree or not? So there'll be a legal process on this. I wouldn't have brought the lawsuit if I didn't think we'd prevail, right? I think we have good arguments, but courts will ultimately decide that. On the political side, I don't spend too much time thinking about when I'm filing a lawsuit or we're talking about our lawsuits, what the political implications of that will be. It's just we're pretty consumed with the law and our cases, and that keeps us pretty busy. I mean, I guess I would hope that when members of Congress see that courts are declaring the President's action unconstitutional, placing injunctions on them, that that raises their awareness of it and keeps the pressure on them to actually do something about it. And I guess lastly, what I would say is that in all the cases we filed, yes, there's always a legal issue that's involved, the Constitution or federal laws. But you know, so much of what's involved goes to Bill's point about our values, really. Each of the cases, they're fundamental to who we are as a people, our immigration, who we allow into our country, and what our values are around that. When it comes to Dreamers, just one thing I'll point out is, in order to become a Dreamer, you have to provide information to the federal government. You have to come out of the shadows. You have to say who you are, where you live, who your family members are. They may or may not be documented, where you work. You get the idea. You got to voluntarily turn that over to the federal government. The federal government has promised not to use that information against those Dreamers to deport them. In fact, there's a federal government website about DACA that has a Q&A, and one of the questions has always been, can the federal government use this information against you? Answer, no. We'll never use that information against you. The day when Attorney General Sessions announced that the President was going to revoke those protections for Dreamers, that question and that answer on the website were removed. There's been no assurance from the federal government that they will not honor their word. Well, that goes to who we are as a people. A deal's a deal, right? I have 9-year-old twins. One of the first things you teach your kids is a deal's a deal. You keep your word. You trade that baseball card with your buddy. You don't get to go back afterwards if you realize you gave up a rookie card, Mickey Mantle, right? Doesn't work that way, right? A deal's a deal. Well, I mean, that goes to this case as well, right? Who we are as a people, and that's what's at stake in this case as well.
So another case, we started this year, February, I think it was, or the end of January, with your lawsuit on the travel ban.
Yeah.
First out of the gate on that one.
Yes.
Can we talk about some of the constitutional principles that were at stake
Sure. In
that case and how that matters to everyone in this room and every American?
Man, well, it was and the travel ban. First I'll just wait. We knew it was a big case. It turned out to be so much bigger than we could possibly imagine. I mean, I just want to be clear, in making the decision when I was with my Solicitor General, we knew it was an important decision, but we just had no sense of scale of what was going to come out of that. I guess for me, I'll try and keep it short. At that time, the travel ban was popular when he issued it. It's important to remember that. And legal experts, if you turned on CNN and watched Anderson Cooper with legal experts like Jeffrey Toobin or Alan Dershowitz, professor at Harvard, they all said a lawsuit will never work. That was the accepted conventional wisdom. That first weekend, we talked it over, and we thought we had good arguments, that we could win. And so it was a combination of feeling we had good arguments, but also I have to say that what the President did, it really pissed me off. I mean, it really...
No.
It really did. I mean, it really did. And I just felt, to Bill's point, I was interested when you said your decision wasn't really a hard one in a certain sense. It was easy in a way. Once you get your mind to a certain place, there are certain lines. I mean, honestly, it was kind of the same way for us, for me. I just felt, yes, we knew it was an important decision, a very important decision, but I got to be honest, in a way, it really wasn't all that hard. Washingtonians are being harmed, they're being turned away at our airports. Students at our universities can't come back to Washington State. It's crazy, right? We think we have good legal arguments, and I, as Attorney General, think I can bring the lawsuit. Well, if the answers to those questions are yes, yes, and yes, why would I not file the lawsuit? It's my job, right? So in a way, it was an easy decision. Of course, recognizing the impacts might be significant. It'd be a bad day at the office if the judge ultimately disagreed with us, right?
Bad weekend, but, too,
but we felt it was
right?
The right thing, yeah. And a lot was at stake in terms of who we are as a country.
Bill, going back in time, President Nixon, as we all know, was facing impending impeachment. Short of him stepping down, which he did, were folks within the administration thinking of ways to possibly limit his power?
To limit his power? Under the Constitutionary, we've, of course, assigned the question of the suitability of the president for his to continue in power to the legislature. It's assigned first to the House, where they have to decide to impeach or charge him. It's not the same thing as convicting. And then to the Senate, where that conviction, they take the charges of the impeachment, see if they're satisfied, and then decide whether or not they're going to ask him to step down. No president has ever gone through that whole process and stepped down. Nixon stopped about halfway through the House and resigned because he was told by the members of the Senate and a few members of the House that he could not survive a vote in the Senate, even though it took two-thirds to ask him to step down. The closest, we've only had three presidents that have come, including Nixon, that have come close to being not only impeached but convicted. The closest, of course, was James or Johnson, Andrew Johnson, and he came within one vote. If there had been one more vote, two-thirds of the members of the Senate would have told him to step down. But it's what we've chosen to use as a method of removing the president. It's been spelled out in the Constitution. And that's what people will support. I mean, if they're going to support it, that's what they'll support. It has to do with timing. Are the members of the legislature in the same party as the president? If they are, forget it. It's not going to happen. I mean, it could happen. It could be a set of circumstances that would force everybody to decide this has gone far enough. But basically, it's going to be up to the first three words of the U.S. Constitution. We the people are going to have to vote and vote strongly that what has been happening, what's going on, is not tolerable. But if that doesn't happen, then there'll be no impeachment.
Thank you, Bill. Bob, I would like to ask you a question. I realize it's a little out of your area of expertise, but it does relate to a constitutional issue. And that is the Senate and House are considering a bill that would prohibit the president from launching a military strike upon North Korea unless war is declared. In your view, would this infringe upon the president's commander-in-chief authority?
Way out of my pay grade. I mean, I just, you know, I've got my hands full with our 19 lawsuits and whatever's coming next. I mean, honestly, that's just not an issue I've wrestled with or looked at, or we've got our hands full to what we've actually got on our plate. Sorry to take a pass on that one, but I just wouldn't want to even wait in yet.
I knew it was a little bit. Bill, do you have any view of that?
Well, there's a provision in the law that allows the president to take his steps if we're attacked. It's been upheld even under the Constitution. So if we were attacked, he would have that authority to move very quickly. He also, I feel certain, even this president would convene the Congress and ask their permission to do what it is he wanted to do to respond. But he has the authority now to that kind of situation.
I have one for you, Mr. Ruckelshaus. The Congress successfully and overwhelmingly agreed to limit some of the president's power by eliminating the ability to remove sanctions against Russia. Is this a smart way to restore balance to our democracy, do you think?
Well, not sure I understand the nature of the question. Is it you think it's a good idea for the Congress to limit?
To sort of preemptively decide that they want to make sure that he doesn't do something, so they go ahead and pass legislation like that.
Well, it's not probably the best way. The best way to do it is the way we haven't been doing it for the last 40 years, and that is working together to try to move the country toward a better place. There's no reason for this extreme polarization that's currently going on. And the reason a question like that arises is because the traditional means of coming together around a real crisis haven't been working. The government at the national level, I mean, I don't think that's true at the state level. At some states it is, but mostly not. The government at the national level is simply not working. And it's necessary for people to begin to pay attention to for whom you vote, for people who genuinely want to work together to advance the country's interest. How many times do you hear the public interest mentioned when you're listening to television? You hear how terrible the other side is. It's just a big waste of time. They ought to be in there working together to solve problems.
If I can just add. Just add one thing on that point. Bill mentioned sort of the dysfunction, I guess, at the congressional level, and your question went to sort of checks on the president that Congress obviously has. There was an interesting article I found interesting, given my role as an AG, was Charles Krauthammer, a conservative columnist, wrote an article, it was several months ago, and his whole article was about the role of AGs, Democratic AGs, challenging the president in the courts and how many people are outraged by that. Hey, what are these AGs doing suing the president?
Right.
And he had an interesting take. He's a conservative. He said, actually, well, hey, if Congress is going to abdicate their role of being a check on the president, our democracy, back to the earlier question about is our democracy under threat, our democracy's elastic, it's fluid, others will fill that void. And his whole premise of his article was Democratic AGs, whether you agree or not, are rightfully filling a void that Congress is abdicating as a check on the executive branch. So kind of back full circle to the earlier question, I think that is an example of that. And even someone like Charles Krauthammer, he and I don't agree a lot, but that was his take on Democratic AGs taking on the president in that fashion.
Let me mention one other example. Andrew Johnson was almost impeached because he tried to fire Edwin Stanton after the Civil War. Who was the Secretary of War. The Congress didn't like Stanton, and many of them would like to see him out, but they came together behind him. And when he faced this effort on the part of the president was defying this Tenure in Office Act, which had been passed by the Congress to protect Edmund Stanton. And the Tenure in Office Act said that if you have appointed somebody in the cabinet and we've confirmed him, you can't fire him until we okay it. And so Stanton actually boarded himself in his office to keep him. And the whole reason that Andrew Johnson was impeached is because he fired one man, or tried to fire one man, never worked. And that law, that was very difficult law to understand why you needed to get permission from the Congress to fire somebody, was finally declared unconstitutional in 1926.
Talking about the health of the democracy and the stresses currently on the Constitution, is hyperpartisanship, you alluded to this, a threat to our democracy?
Well, it certainly is, because a lot of things don't happen that should happen. There are a number of problems that our country's faced now for a couple of decades, for which there are a number of solutions. Let's just take Social Security as an example. Social Security is going to run out of money at some point, not too far in the future. There are a lot of solutions to Social Security. If reasonable people were to sit down and say, we need to continue to care for people when they reach the age in which they're eligible for Social Security, but we need to do it in such a way that it doesn't occupy the whole budget. How can we do that? Well, those kinds of problems, if we were functioning as the government, would be solved. And there are a number of them. And That's what gets in the way of progress in a country like ours, is people who won't work together or who refuse to, or because of the nature of our society right now or our government right now, they can't get together and solve a problem. Those kinds of problems would begin to go away, and then I think people would gain confidence that it's possible for us to work together and solve things.
You want to chime in on that?
I'm not sure I can improve on that answer. I guess all I would say is, I feel very fortunate. I'm from a family of seven kids in my family, six boys, one long-suffering sister. And so it's in a way, it's a real gift, because for the family to stay functional, right, to not fall into dysfunction, you've got to find a way to navigate the differences that seven people plus two parents will naturally have around the dinner table. Politics, Huskies, Cougars, you name it, right? And do in the way where everybody's, you learn to appreciate people can have strongly held positions opposite to you, and yet you have many things more in common than you disagree with, right? And you have to get along, you must get along, or the family falls into dysfunction. And I think that comes when you stop talking to each other or truly listening to each other. There's a number of things, and I worry that's what's happening, right? We get into our tribes, so much has been written about this, and I'll just say, like, you know, for myself, I think it's easy to end up talking only to the people who agree with you, right? And
that's happened to media,
right?
In a lot of ways, right?
And I think it's important for all elected officials, for example, to force themselves to get out and listen to folks who may not agree. So I'll just give you an example. In the middle, of the travel ban, I spoke to a Rotary Club in Vashon Island, right? Standing ovation, more Bernie supporters per capita than anywhere in the world, right? literally.
That's actually verifiable.
And that's verifiable. That's true, right? That's verifiable. It's verifiable. And like 2 days later, I spoke to a small Rotary in the deepest red part of our state. There was no standing ovation, I want to be clear, right? I still gave the same talk and still spoke about the travel ban, and I'm not saying I changed anyone's mind in Eastern Washington, but I do think that they left with some more information about why I did it, and I think I learned something from the conversation back and the questions they raised as well. So the key is you got to force yourself, even if you know it's going to be an uncomfortable conversation, just like with your siblings or with anybody else, and I think that is missing more and more in the public debate.
Let me give you a quick example of how easy it is to cooperate if everybody decides they want to. In 1970, when the Clean Air Act first passed, and it was a massive piece of legislation aimed at cleaning up the air in the country. We had never done that on a united basis. But Senator Muskie and Senator Baker were the majority leader, the chairman and ranking member of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. When I first began to administer that law, it was obvious there are a lot of problems with it. Inevitably, there are going to be a big piece of legislation covering the whole country, automobiles, buildings, power plants. And so I went up to see both Muskie and Senator Baker, Howard Baker from Tennessee, and said, look, this law is a good law, and it can be very beneficial to us, but there are parts of it that need adjustment. They just have not anticipated all the issues that we could face in trying to clean up the air. So I'll just bring these issues for adjustment up to the two of you. And about once a month, we'd meet and go over what needed to change, and they would agree. And I said, okay, we'll put this aside until we've got enough of them here after 10 or 12 months, and we'll all three of us introduce them. They won't know what to do about that. Confuse them all. So they said, fine. And we agreed on every single one of them. There was no dispute over it. There was no animus in the meetings. We got along fine. Muskie was running for president, subsequently so was Howard Baker. But they still endorsed all these changes, and a number of them were enacted into law in the early days of the EPA.
I wanted to ask you both about the freedom of the press, since I'm a longtime journalist and have listened to some of the things that have been said, attempts to seek prior restraint on book publishing, the press is the enemy of the people. Do you think that these challenges, these comments, we talked about institutions, do you think they ultimately weaken the press or make it stronger?
I think it makes it stronger. I think that people see the importance of the promise of free press in the First Amendment by watching much more carefully what's going on than they normally do. I think a lot more people are glued to their television sets and watching people from different points of view, certainly, different worlds, really, and can ferret out of that who's leveling with them and who isn't. And I personally think that freedom of the press is such a fundamental freedom that we must do everything in our power to ensure that it survives. And if you're in office, you're occasionally going to get accused of doing something you think you didn't do. That's okay. That's fine. As long as we have a free press, the chances are these institutions that we're trying to preserve will come out okay.
I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, I'm paraphrasing probably poorly, if it's a choice between having newspapers, right, without government or government without newspapers, I would choose newspapers without government, I think was essentially his words.
Yeah.
And that's that resonates, right?
Yeah.
That in terms of how important that was to our, you know, the folks who put our Constitution together and the way they contemplated that democracy and the stresses that'd be incumbent on it. So I guess back to my kind of earliest point, though, I do worry about that corrosive nature that emanates from the executive branch, the fake news, and what I think it's going to be hard to know what in the end that will do. I think in a way it will make it stronger. I do.
I can only say that I saw the Post over the weekend, and that is the first time I've seen the press in recent years. It presented in a good light, and of course it was a Seattle audience, but they clapped. For the press, when does that go on? Not enough.
Okay, now we're going to pivot to impeachment. When we met with Bill Ruckelshaus last week, he said, you know, you ought to give some background information on impeachment. So I came up with some brief remarks here covering the history, process, and content. The House of Representatives, since our founding, has voted by a simple majority to impeach 19 government officials, 13 of whom were district court judges. Two presidents, Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton, have been impeached, and Richard Nixon would probably have been impeached except that he instead resigned his office. Of the 19 impeached officials, eventually the Senate acquitted 7 of them. In one case, the charge was dismissed, 3 resigned, and 8 were found guilty and were removed from office. Now, regards the process. As prescribed by the U.S. Constitution, the House of Representatives votes on a bill of impeachment, and that bill passes if it receives a simple majority. The bill of impeachment is somewhat similar to an indictment. The bill then passes on to the Senate, where they hear evidence in a courtroom-like setting with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presiding. The Senate decides by a 2/3 vote whether the charged official should be removed from office. Now, regards the content, the Constitution states that impeached officials can be removed in cases of bribery, treason, or high crimes and misdemeanors. Terms bribery and treason are somewhat straightforward. The meanings of high crimes and misdemeanors are a little more murky. Indeed, the founders did not define what they meant by high crimes and misdemeanors. However, some legal scholars are in general agreement that a high crime or misdemeanor occurs if an official in some egregious way violates the public trust. Bill, I have a question for you.
You going to impeach me now?
Back in the early 70s, Gerald Ford, who was the House Minority Leader, was interested in impeaching Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. And at the time, he said basically that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at a given moment. Do you agree?
Gerald Ford told me once before he died that was the worst decision he ever made in his life, was to try to get Justice Douglas impeached. He stuck with it for quite a while and was never successful. If you disagree with the judge's opinions or if you disagree with the president's policies, that is not an impeachable moment or impeachable duty that you violated. So, I mean, I think that particular event in his life is not the thing that I would like to remember most about him.
Mr. Attorney General, at what point is advocating for impeachment a smart or dumb strategy for Democrats?
Just sort of
so you have some folks out there right now. You have a big funder of the Democrats, you know, big website, lots of social media, already talking about impeachment. Does that help or hurt Democrats, do you think?
Just politically, you mean,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I'm talking politically.
Kind of my earlier point, I don't spend a whole lot of time thinking about things I can't control or write. So I guess I think it's a reasonable conversation to be having, and that's not just me speaking. One of my predecessors was Slate Gordon, right? He was an attorney general for 12 years before he became a U.S. senator, Republican, and he was interviewed. I forget where I saw his interview, but he was asked the question about impeachment, and I think I'm paraphrasing accurately. He said, I think we're getting close to that point already in terms of obstruction of justice. I mean, he was pretty candid about where he thought things were at. Yeah, and so...
I mean, I know he wasn't a Trump person. I interviewed him before the election. He was pretty
But he was pretty candid.
Yes.
And by the way, he was the first Washingtonian of prominence to call for Nixon's resignation, by the way. Great risk to himself, I'll point out, when he was attorney general. But so, look, am I deeply disturbed by what I see in terms of potential obstruction of justice? You bet. Politically, man, I mean, so much depends on where you are as an elected official, what state you're in, what your districts are, right? So it's going to be different for one person than for another. I just will put that out there, number one. Number two, I guess I'm just not sure I'm the guy to ask. I just don't, you know, I don't spend much time, you know, thinking about in those terms. I guess I would just say, though, it's important to... you know, like, for me, the obstruction of justice, the signs I've seen, what's been reported already, I find the signs so far to be troubling, okay? And I think as long as, I think let the investigator do their work, right? Let them do the report, have that come out. I'll be intensely interested in what that has to say. But I think there's a process here. It's going on. Unless that is jeopardized in some way, all bets are off at that point. As long as they're allowed to do the work, release their report, I think it's a fair game for conversation, and we'll see when the report comes out.
Administrative thing. If you have a question, could you please pass it to the end of the aisle, and Lindsay will pick them up.
Go ahead.
The question of impeachment is a serious one, and that's one of the things I'm sure, Larry, you've gleaned from reading the background of the use of the impeachment mechanism to gain some kind of...
You gave us both a lot of reading after we talked to you last week. we did it.
It's a question of when. In my view today, until we hear from Mueller and his investigation as to what he's found, we're not going to know enough about the facts to know exactly what trying to impeach somebody because you disagree with their policies is almost anti-democratic in some ways, because they were elected and they were, and just because you don't like what they're doing, that's what they said they were going to do. So it's okay not to like it, but that isn't necessarily grounds for impeachment. We have an investigation going on about these cooperation with Russia during the last campaign. Mueller is a first-rate lawman, prosecutor, head of the FBI for 10 years, then another one. He is an absolutely straightforward, honest man. If he's allowed to do his work and the president doesn't intervene and try to fire him, and I've had some experience with that, I was both fired and resigned. I was fired, announced Saturday night, and the next Monday the president announced my resignation had been accepted. So I can take either position. I digress. I'm sorry, but I do.
Good digression. Good hard-hitting digression.
I think we have to wait until Mueller's report comes in, assuming he is allowed to finish. And then, depending on what the reaction is to that in the Congress and in the public, depending on who's in the Congress, if it's still the same party that's there with the president, the history of this is that impeachment efforts go nowhere because the party will close ranks and try to protect the president. So, you know, the one thing I would warn those of you who think impeachment should be tried is there's an old adage that never shoot at the king unless you hit him. And that's not an adage you all use every night, I'm sure. Nevertheless, I do think that there needs to be a stronger case, and it needs to be buttressed by a examination, an investigation like we're going through with Mueller, and see where that comes out.
Okay. Bill, based on what we know now, do you think that the firing of FBI Director James Comey was the equivalent or similar to when Nixon ordered you to fire Archibald Cox?
No, it wasn't. I think Comey, I'm just speculating here, but I think Comey was fired because he was not cooperating with the president in the investigation which Mueller is now heading. And he did not give, at least as far as I've been able to glean, Mueller a direct order to do something. In the case of Nixon, I was ordered to fire Archibald Cox. Archibald Cox had, when I was the director of the FBI, which was about 4 months, I was conducting the investigation under the leadership of Archibald Cox. I would meet with him every morning and he'd say, here's what we're going to do. Today, can you give me the following agents to follow up on that? And I would say yes every time. I wasn't there to run the investigation for him. That was his job. And when the president asked me to fire him, I could find nothing wrong that Archibald Cox had done. I had promised the president that I would not fire him except for extraordinary improprieties. That was the phrase we used. And not only had he not done an extraordinary improper method, everything he'd done was positive. I would get calls from the White House saying he's sometimes from the president, mostly from Al Haig, who was then the chief of staff, saying that Archibald Cox is getting into areas he shouldn't be involved in. He should stay out of that. Every time I talked to Archibald Cox about it, he backed off. He said, I do not want to be accused even remotely of not carrying out my responsibilities, so I'm going forward. And I told him that. I said, there's no reason to fire him.
Bob, there's been increasing talk about using the 25th Amendment. And under a provision of the 25th Amendment, if the Vice President and a majority of the Cabinet declare before the Congress that the president is unfit to serve, he can be removed from office. However, if the president disagrees with that, which he probably would.
Sounds like a law school exam question already.
the cabinet and the vice president would have to make another case before the Congress, and it would require a two-thirds vote in both the House and the Senate. Is this even a more unrealistic scenario than impeachment?
Yeah, I guess what I can say is, look, I'm not a 25th Amendment expert, right? I think what I can say is, for myself, what I find most concerning right now, and what I'm seeing is just what you see. I don't have any other information, right? I just read the newspapers and see what's going on, is potential obstruction of justice, right? What's going on with Russia, right? Those things are of interest. The 25th Amendment, I don't know, right? And so in terms of legalities of that or how that'd be enforced, that's not where I'm focused to the extent I think about that. Frankly, I think my personal view, the time that's best spent for everybody, whatever role we happen to have, right, journalist, right, citizen, attorney general, is, you know, focus on what we can control and what we can do, because there's a lot there, is my view. There's a lot there. And I know it's interesting, but I feel like that can be like the shiny object right now is this 25th Amendment discussion that's going on. I get that. It's interesting, and I know there's the book out that I haven't read that gets to it, but I don't know. I guess I just prefer to focus on things that I feel to me are more tangible and more real that are happening right now. And so I just don't know in terms of the legality of how that plays out.
By the way, if you are New York Times subscribers, the editorial today is on the 25th Amendment. I seriously recommend that you read it.
New York Times?
Yeah, and the punchline basically is don't count on the 25th Amendment. The punchline is, you know, do the normal checks and balances and vote next year in 2018, basically, is the ending of the editorial. But sort of playing out this idea of a constitutional stress test, and you both alluded to this, Mr. Ruckelshaus, you know, all eyes and you are on Bob Mueller, as they should be. If he is somehow fired, how does that change the calculus of what we're discussing?
Oh, that's a big difference then. The president has fired the man charged by both the Constitution and by the Justice Department with investigating activities that he may have been involved in. And you know, nobody should go around have the power to fire their investigator, their own personal investigator. And when the Saturday Night Massacre took place, the House immediately convened the Rodino Committee. This was in October. In the first part of November, they convened the Rodino Committee to investigate impeaching the president. By the following July, the Supreme Court's efforts to, or the Supreme Court turned over the incriminating tapes to the special prosecutor, by then a different man, obviously, than Archibald Cox. But that was, in and of itself, that was enough the tape that showed that he had a smoking gun in every hand and every pocket were sufficient to convince the Congress that they had to move. And by the 9th of August, they did. They forced his resignation. He could have stayed on, but he would have been not only impeached, but convicted.
So, Bob, you were shaking your head. Firing a special prosecutor, counsel in this case?
Yeah, absolute game changer if that happens. You'd see members of both parties in Congress expressing that. I just think that'd be that's a bridge too far for the president. And it sort of reminds me of, to such a degree that I remember after that first travel ban, when we won, and the federal judge, Judge Robart, here in the Western District of Washington, issued his order stopping it. And there was a period when national news was saying, hey, will the president honor that order, right, by that federal judge, right? And look, that'd be a constitutional crisis, right? If the president did not honor the actions of a federal judge, it'd be the same thing.
He was a so-called judge, right?
And he called him a so-called judge, right? And that's exactly right. And so I would, appointed by George W. Bush, so-called judge. And but I would say that it'd be a similar situation here if there was a firing.
That kind of takes us in that.
You're in a whole nother ball game at that point.
That's right. You are. And for both cases, that you trigger a process that you're then very much a part of. And the reason the Nixon tried to fire Archibald Cox, he was getting too close. From my vantage point, that's what I expected, and it turned out to be true. The same thing would be true if the current president tried that with Mueller. The public would decide, Mueller's onto something, and that's why he's being cashiered.
Excellent word. Okay, so we'll open up the your fine questions from the audience.
And there are many of them.
Yeah.
Bill, when you returned to the EPA as the fifth administrator, you were exceedingly effective at rebuilding the agency and its mission. Will it be possible to rebuild the EPA after Pruitt? On the central environmental challenges of this generation, how far have we been set back by Pruitt and this administration?
It was relatively easy to restore EPA's morale and mission. In 1983, and the administrator at the time was not nearly as skillful as this one is in identifying the weak points in the mission of EPA and taking advantage of them. He can do a lot of damage. The EPA operates through the rulemaking, and there's rules that are under study, there are rules that have been proposed, there are rules that are halfway through. It takes about 2 years to get through the whole process of adopting a new rule. He's gone after every one of them. He's stopped the ones before they're surfaced. He's tried to reverse where the rule is going now. These are all to protect public health, to protect public health and the environment. He's determined to do it, and he hasn't got the best lawyers in the world, but he's got some good ones. And there are a lot of people resisting that, including attorneys general around the country, as well as environmental organizations that are trying the same thing. Nevertheless, he can do a lot of damage, particularly if he's there for 4 years, that will take a long time to recover. We are where we are today in cleaning up the environment is 44 years of work. It's not perfect. I mentioned it a little while ago, government doesn't always work. EPA is not a perfect agency. It makes people mad, and they don't like to be told what to do by the government. They don't like to be told how to manage their land. And they don't like necessarily paying more money for something because it's got environmental protection and public health protection in it. But those functions are crucial for free societies to perform at the governmental level, or it cannot succeed. And if we tear this whole apparatus down, this infrastructure that's been put in place, it'll be a long time for us to recover.
Just one thing I would add to that is, agreeing with everything Bill said, one thing that's been helpful for us, and we've worked with other AGs, California and Massachusetts and New York in particular, on these issues with the APA and Mr. Pruitt, is that fortunately for us, from a legal perspective, in their rush, the current administration, in their rush to roll back all those environmental protections put in place by the Obama administration that Bill alluded to, they are very sloppy in how they do that from a legal perspective. I'll spare you the legal details of something called the Administrative Procedure Act. You know you're in trouble with an audience if you're quoting the Administrative Procedure Act. But but it's a law, a federal law, that requires agencies to... It's the equivalent of telling your 9-year-old twins when my kids do their multiplication, they have to show their work, right? Right? You know how that, you have to show your work. You can't just write an answer, you got to show how you got there. It's the same thing with the Administrative Procedure Act. You have to have public comments, you've got to do an analysis, you've got to pro-con it, you've got to do a process before you reach a decision. Fortunately for us on the legal front, one of the reasons we've had so much success is we've gone back to that Administrative Procedure Act over and over and over again, because they're in such a rush, I'm convinced, to roll all those things back all at one time, they leave, frankly, gaping holes for my legal team to exploit, and that's why we've been successful.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Attorney William Ruckelshaus and Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson took questions from Larry Hubbell, Director of Seattle University's Institute of Public Service, and multimedia journalist Joni Balter at SU's Pigott Hall on January 11th. Thank you to Jenny Cecil Moore for our recording. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.